Welcome, everyone, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Baldwin. And on the show, we are not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We will break kayfabe on sports, movie, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. And on today's show, we're going to discuss these things and more with, guess who? It's Barry Rose. What's up, Barry?
It's all good. I am sitting on the couch, pretty excited about what we have planned for this afternoon. Got my dog by my side, and I'm ready to go.
The dog's name for the listeners?
Is Ozzy, my
third
child.
Ozzy the dog.
Yep.
Well, I'm going to open up and be a little more personal with the listeners. My dogs are Molly and Gunny. Molly is my dog. Gunny is my other son. That's the way I refer to Gunny. I get emotional talking about him. So, today on Breaking Kayfabe, we're going to discuss some more of my top 100. For the first time, we are going to be discussing from the 1989 Wrestling Observer Yearbook, my top 21 moments of the decade in wrestling. I don't know why I settled on 21 as opposed to 20. Maybe I just had one more that I had to squeeze in there. And for the first time, Barry and I are going to discuss, this is not going to be easy, Barry, our top five episodes of Seinfeld. Are you up to the task?
I'm up to the task, and I got to say, so of all the top five and top ten lists that we've done thus far, I've been up since 3 a.m., and I've been watching Seinfeld, and my top five is probably, except for number one, which is pretty steady for me, two through five have changed about six or seven times at this point. So, yeah, I'm ready to go.
And as I mentioned to Barry earlier, I, much like you, have a number one that has always been my number one favorite episode. But I actually came up with, as I was trying to narrow the list, I started off with something like 15 episodes. And honestly, this is such a subjective list. If you're a fan of Seinfeld, it could change tomorrow, my two through five. So we're going to throw some episodes, some great moments out there, and we'll be discussing that. But first, we're going to take a look. 1984 on July 4th, and we're going to Dallas, Texas, and we're going to be discussing one of the great feuds in the history of wrestling, not just the 80s. We're talking Freebirds versus Von Erichs, Dallas, Texas, on 4th of July evening. Barry, does it still hold up as one of my top 100?
It does. What was the number of this match again?
I did a 1 through 20, and the other 80 were just randomly totaled. I didn't actually number them. But these were not in my top 20, but they were definitely part of my top 100.
Gotcha. So it's a great match, and I was taking a bunch of notes as I was watching this. And what I liked about the match too, it wasn't a 45-minute match. This was 10 minutes, and it was from the get go. The second that it's a street fight, it's a bad street match. The second that the Freebirds enter the ring, it's game on, and it's probably Mike Von Erich's best match ever. And Mike was obviously really limited in what he could do, and there's certainly been a lot of criticism, but he's fine in this match. Von Erich's come down to the ring. They're playing LaGrange by ZZ Top, which I really liked. I will say this. So Ralph Pulley was the ring announcer, and he was terrible. Is he still with us, or has he passed on?
To be honest with you, I do not know the answer to that question. I'll tell you one thing I noticed.
Sure.
I don't know who was the referee in this match, because this was not, Bronco Lubitsch or David Manning. This was a guy that I did not recognize.
It wasn't Rick Hazard either, actually, now that I think about it. I don't know who the ref was. I mean, so that you bring up a funny scenario. Imagine putting Bronco Lubitsch in this match.
Yeah.
Slow Bronco. wasn't gonna work, but it's a great match. It's right out of the gate. Again, Mike Von Erich's best match, I would say, ever. When you watch the match, how stiff were the Von Erich boys? And I know that we hear that all the time, that, there was a lot of potatoes being laid in, but you can watch Kerry just pounding away. And I'm watching Buddy, and poor old Buddy's just in the corner, and Kerry's laying him in. And I just know that he's just potatoing the crap out of him. But there's a spot in here where Kerry is holding Buddy. Buddy ducks, and Mike Von Erich nails Kerry. Now, did you see that?
I don't recall seeing that.
Because I was going to say, what's your take on something like that? That's generally a heel spot where the heel holds a guy, somebody
else. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so it made no sense to me, and Mike kind of makes this this gesture after where he puts his hands up in the air like, what just happened? And they move right on from it. Obviously, nobody's turning on anybody, so that was really odd. But I love the match. This was such a great feud, and I think this was close to the end of it as far as the Freebirds were going to the Federation. They were in New York within a month or two of this match. I know that they were there by the summer of 84.
Let's take a little historical context. This program had been going on at this point for a year and a half. Of course, this all started with the famous angle, Christmas night of 1982 inside the steel cage, a match that we will be discussing at a later date, as that was part of my top 20, the famous match between Kerry Von Erich and Ric Flair. But the angle was so good that here we have it a year and a half later. The program is still white hot, and the program went on even though David had passed. Mike took over. Mike, being extremely generous, was probably the least, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to say athletic. He was the worst of the six. I'll put it that way. Sorry to the Von Erich clan, but Mike was but as Barry pointed out, he was completely acceptable in this match. He did a spot where he did the flying head scissors over the top rope on Buddy. And I was kind of like, wow, that was actually pretty well done. A couple other things. I like the whole entrance, Bad Street versus LaGrange, two good entrance songs. It was literally the reaction of the crowd. It was like being at a rock concert. It was that loud because the shrieks of the teenage girls who were there to cheer for the Von Erichs was just an amazing audio reaction. Terry Gordy in this match just is a champion. I mean, you're watching this guy in the ring and you're going, oh my God, how was this guy not ever considered for a world title run until, you know, a couple of years later when Bill Watts came along? But I mean, I really wonder why, and I guess I'm saying why, and I kind of know the reason. This guy would have been a great challenger to Hogan at some point in the 80s because he had the size. He would have made Hogan look like an absolute champion. There's a great spot. You talked about the spot you like. My favorite spot was when, I believe it was Kerry, has one of the Freebirds, I'm not sure if it was Hayes or Gordy, down on the ropes, on maybe the bottom ropes, and he had taken his boot off and was sitting with the boot. He loses the boot. The boot falls down to the floor. A fan picks up the boot and tosses it to Kerry, who catches it and hits him in one motion. It was just fantastic. Do you remember that?
I do remember that, too. And hey, wasn't Meltzer at this match also?
I know he lived in Texas at this point. He went to a lot of the stuff in 83. I'm not sure if in 84 he was still there, but he was pretty much there for the whole genesis of this feud and the entire progress of the feud during 83. I'm not sure if by middle of 84 he was still there or not.
Yeah, I think he was too, because I remember reading his review of this match and what he thought about it, and it was great too. I love the ending too. I thought the ending was so cool. It was kind of a surprise to me. Didn't expect that to happen. I'll let you kind of recap the ending, but I love the ending. The finish.
Well, what happens is, first of all, you get in a promotion that was notorious for never doing it. You got double juice. You got Michael Hayes and Kevin Von Erich both getting color, which was very surprising at the time. And then here at the end of the match comes our old friend Barry Killer Khan. Boy, we're like mentioning this guy every week. He comes in, does the double team. The Freebirds get the win, kind of like you said, a big surprise because I believe they were going to the WWF. And but as someone said, this match put the Bad Street match over in Texas for years as being the equivalent of what the Coal Miner's Glove was in Mid-South.
Yeah, what I liked about it, too, was it was definitely a surprise when the finish came, but Kerry wound up doing the job. And that wasn't something that normally, you know, again, you had Mike in the match. That would be my expectation, or, you know, Buddy, if the Freebirds were going to be doing the job. So I think it was pretty effective. You know, Kerry goes up to the ring ropes. He's up on the middle rope. Khan shows up, hits him, goes down, gets pinned 1, 2, 3. Freebirds get out of the ring quick. And you know, the first thing that goes through my head, too, when I watch a match like this, and the heat is white hot. I mean, the fans are just really going nuts. Is there going to be a riot? You know, the Golden Boy just got pinned by the Nefarious Heels. Is there going to be a riot? Because the people believed.
Yeah, this is one of these crowds that the intensity of the crowd is such that it's almost scary intensity. You know, like they talk about having heat with the crowd, and then there's the point where you realize that it's too much heat. And it almost got to that point. It was getting a little scary. And speaking of One last thing. I was reminded that Ralph Pulley is no longer with us. He died a few years back. So rest in peace, Ralph. The next match, speaking of White Heat that we're going to talk about, we're going to go to June 6th of 1984. I'm sorry, June 16th. We're going to Madison Square Garden. I believe in one of our previous episodes, Barry, we discussed the Sergeant Slaughter versus Pat Patterson alley street fight. You liked it, felt it still held up. I thought that it was a really good match, but not necessarily a top 100 match. But today we're going to talk about the Sergeant Slaughter match against the Iron Sheik in the Boot Camp Death Match. You had a chance to watch it. What do you think?
So here's the kicker. I was living in New York City for the majority of 1984, and I went to about a half dozen MSG cards. I was scheduled to go to this card, and I wound up I was working at Tavern on the Green in New York City, and I had to work, and I couldn't go. And somebody that I was working with actually went, and they raved about this match. And I was really pissed off that I couldn't go. And as I watched this match today, I could feel myself just sweating a little bit on my upper lip and getting a little bit tense and still pissed, you know, some 33 years later that I didn't get to go to this match. That being said, I am going to stick with what I originally said, and I still believe that the Patterson-Slaughter street fight is better. So I'll tell you what I like about this match. And again, it's a really good match. There's nothing wrong with it. The crowd definitely makes it. You know, they show the crowd several times, the fans, and everybody's standing. And much like that Freebird match, and you and I have mentioned this now for several weeks, probably I've mentioned this every week, is that in a grudge match like this, I don't want to see guys who truly hate each other sit in a headlock for 5 minutes. And this is right out of the gate. There's no time wasted. He gets in the ring, Slaughter gets in the ring, and they just start going at it. And McMahon, too. So McMahon he's taken a lot of criticism for a lot of different things, and a lot of it's valid. But as an announcer in the 80s, he was really good because he had that kind of vibe of the excitement of a fan. He wasn't a guy that was analytical and maybe going to describe different parts of your body like Gordon Solie. Here was, you know, he was more of a cheerleader. And I really liked what he did. You know, with this, he's going, listen to them say USA. You know, he's putting forth the whole Iran versus USA, but he's really selling the USA aspect in the crowd. So I really liked that. What did you think about this one?
Okay, well, just again, here's this word again for some context. When we viewed this match recently to take a look at whether or not it still hold up, what we did was we not only looked at the match, we looked at the angle that created the program. And the match itself was not called by Vince. It was called by Gorilla Monsoon and Gene Okerlund.
Right, but that's my fault because...
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
The angle, though, was called by Vince. And you're absolutely right about Vince being the cheerleader, almost a David Crockett, Larry Nelson-esque performance. But he was absolutely great here because he is so electric at putting over the USA versus Iran thing. A couple things I noted was just a crazy intensity during the TV angle, when Fred Blassie, the Ayatollah Fred Blassie, comes out to the ring with the Iron Sheik, and they're doing the bit where they're, you know, holding up the Iranian flag, and the Sheik is bowing in praise to the Iranian flag, and McMahon is just completely outraged. And then Slaughter comes in. He's, you know, kissing the American flag. He holds it up. And as he's saluting the American flag, he gets back jumped by the Iron Sheik. And this sets off the whole thing. The Sheik takes off his belt. For some reason, he's wearing wrestling trunks, but he has a belt on. And he starts whipping the Sergeant Slaughter, the American hero, including a couple shots where he hits Slaughter right in the face with the end of the belt. Man, that had to hurt. And so then we go to the match itself, okay? Here's a couple things I noted. Number one, the crowd was different than any normal for the 80s type of WWF crowd. And I think this may have been the last match that is like sort of, for lack of a better way of putting it, an older school WWF match. Meaning, number one, you look in the crowd, there is no merchandise being worn by anybody in the crowd.
Yep.
It's an older crowd. You don't see that many kids. So they're there because they want to see a brawl. They want to see somebody get their ass kicked. And it was something that I couldn't help noticing. He The Sheik once again has the belt. He starts and boy, those strap shots by both guys are so stiff. And believe it or not, one of the persons I thought that added something as far as the intensity of the match, and this is something you don't hear very often, is Gene Okerlund. Gene Okerlund, at one point when I believe the Sheik is strapping Sergeant Slaughter, lets out the immortal words, "Judas Priest." So he's either a closet metal fan or he's really getting into this match. And you know, any match is better when the announcer is really getting into it. And there's this point where both guys, of course, both guys end up hitting gushers and they're both just bleeding something fierce. And Gene turns to Gorilla and says, "This is man's inhumanity to man." And it was just such a perfect line for the time. And, you know, just so completely over the top, but it was so great, and it's for the time and stuff like that. And the point in the match where Sergeant Slaughter, the Sheik's belt has been dropped on the mat. They're both dripping blood and the belt is lying there. And Sergeant Slaughter begins this slow crawl across the ring to get to the belt. And just before the Sheik gets back to the belt and gets it again, the Sarge grabs the belt and picks it up. The pop from the crowd when he did that just blew the roof off the garden. It was incredible.
Yeah, so there were a couple of great spots I liked. One was Slaughter puts on the helmet and starts giving a headbutt to the Iron Sheik, which I just thought that's great. That's really unique. And then there's this spot where Slaughter goes to whip the Sheik into the turnbuckles. The Sheik reverses it, and Slaughter goes flying over the top rope, but he goes flying over the turnbuckle, which really requires something. So that was really unique. But so this is a match also where I would say the blood truly added to the match. And, you know, there was a lot of blood overkill in the 80s, especially 80s going into 90s with ECW, where, you know, the prelim matches, you would see blood. But this was something that you truly believed. And I think WWF at this point was really setting the stage for the big stage. You know, this match was being presented, and you were 100% right when you talk about, you look out in the crowd and it's an older crowd and everybody is standing. There's nobody sitting, but the way that this is presented, like, this is the real deal. This is the big stage. Everything that you've seen prior to tonight is filler. This is why you're here. And I think it works on that action. So in your opinion, what would make this better than the Patterson-Slaughter street fight?
You know, I just think that I don't want to poo-poo the Patterson-Slaughter fight. They were both great matches. I just preferred this one. I thought the crowd was a little bit more invested in this one. I thought the Slaughter-Patterson match had a few more down moments in it. You know, you talked about the headlock, you know, being something that shouldn't be a part of a grudge match. And I thought there were more moments where there was a rest period, not necessarily a rest hold, but where they were taking a break. There was a moment towards the end of the match when the Sheik rolls out onto the floor and he's lying there, and someone in the first row, I don't know if they spit on him or they threw something at him, but you could really see the crowd was just, and you know, that brings me to one of the questions I wanted to ask you. Was Slaughter better as a heel or as a babyface, in your opinion?
Oh, well, that's a tough one right there. So I think he was better as a heel, but did he get over better as a babyface because he was representing our country? I don't know. That's a tough one right there. I like that.
And again,
I prefer him as a heel, but I prefer
him. I mean, there's no right or wrong answer. It's just all subjective opinion. But at this point in the early part of 84 to the summer, as a babyface, he was really incredible. And I say that knowing, because I can recall at the point this was, you know, first happening, of course, USA Network was nationwide, so I could watch the WWF show. And I can recall at the time when they did this angle, my dad, who really was not into wrestling at all, I said, "Dad," you know, my dad was ex-military, "you got to see this." And he's watching this. He got caught up in the program and was, you know, in his own way, kind of laughing at the over-the-top USA stuff, but he got a little emotionally involved in wanting to see the Iron Sheik, the guy from Iran, get his butt kicked by the patriotic Sergeant Slaughter. So here we have somebody who's not a wrestling fan who finds himself getting, if not to the extent I was, but getting a little bit emotionally involved. And I think that's really says a lot for the promotion and the way they handle it, because, you know, I got to be honest with you, even though Hogan was white hot, like you said, I think they came to the arena that night to see this match.
I think they did too, and if I remember reading correctly, and I wasn't getting the Observer in 1984, but I would go back and read some of the older issues that he was the most over guy. Even with Hogan coming in, Slaughter was really still the guy at that point. And what was the impetus for him actually leaving? Was it something over the rights to like a G.I. Joe doll or something like that?
I think he had been reached out to by G.I. Joe. And of course, Vince, I don't know if Vince wanted either a taste of that or Vince wanted to go with his own line of figures and wanted Slaughter to be part of that. And then I've heard some scuttlebutt that maybe Slaughter was talking about forming a wrestlers union, which is really ironic because the guy has been a guy behind the scenes for the WWE for 20 plus years at least. So it's funny that someone who was doing something that was completely against the corporate philosophy has now been brought back into the fold and is part of the corporation for 20 plus years. But yeah, so in my personal estimation, this match is not only holds up, it was a great match. It was a great brawl. It's tremendous fun. But much like some of the other matches we've reviewed in prior episodes, this is one that I think you appreciate the context of the match much more if you sit and watch the angle that led to it. And, you know, I don't really know that you have to do that with the Freebirds and Von Erichs, but in this one, it definitely helps out.
Yeah, too, and if you're going to sit there and watch the Freeburg-Von Erich thing, that's going to take you about 2 weeks to do that. So I'm not sure you'd be able to do that. But these are both good matches, too. And it's funny, as I was going through the list this morning of all the matches that you and I have talked about over the last few weeks, and I think only one of the matches that we've discussed truly hasn't held up, which was the Don Nakaya-Nielsen match against Akira Maeda.
Well, there was a couple more that, you know, and I have to say, well, that's the only one that specifically probably does not belong. There was a couple, I think, that we felt maybe didn't hold up. They were still really good matches. And if they weren't on the top 100 list, they'd probably be like somewhere in the 10 next matches.
Right.
But that's another episode, Barry. Don't go giving a spoiler to the fans here. So now we're going to transition. Also in the 1989 Observer Yearbook, as I mentioned, I did great wrestling memories of the 1980s. I did a top 21 list of things that happened. We're not going to cover every single one of them. We're going to go half of them here. And just sort of off the top of our heads, memories of these particular angles, moments that happened that were just great and were part of what made wrestling in the 1980s so special. Barry, here's one we're going to start off with that we've talked about in a previous episode. Terry Funk attacks Ric Flair after the match in Nashville, screaming maniacally, "He said I'm not good enough."
So I love it. There's no, again, Terry Funk can do no wrong to me, wrong for me. And I love Ric Flair, at least at this stage. I loved Ric Flair. So this was at a period where I was probably getting a little bored with professional wrestling in the USA. You know, Japan was still great. But when Terry Funk, and I didn't expect it, and I don't know if I was just brain dead, but I didn't expect what we were going to see that night. And I thought that was just mind blowing. Fantastic.
Yeah, it was a great angle. I happened to be lucky enough to be there in person. And it was just really amazing. And of course, as I mentioned on a previous episode, the fact that the table was apparently supposed to be gimmicked and somebody forgot to gimmick the table. I'm sure Ric Flair really appreciated that as his head was hitting the wood of the table there. So number 20, Ricky Steamboat rips off Ric Flair's clothes in the Clash of Champions in Cleveland. This was an angle that had been done previously in Mid-Atlantic. I want to say, we're talking mid to late 70s, but this was not something they had seen on the national scale. Ric Flair is apparently a guy that he enjoys having his clothes removed and showing his ass to the fans because it's something in the arenas that you see when they pull Rick's trunks down. He walks around with his ass hanging out. But on a national stage, no one had seen him torn down to his BVDs.
Well, yeah, if the stories are true, then Ric Flair enjoys being naked walking around just about everywhere.
Including on an airplane, by the way.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was a good angle. You know, growing up in Florida, we actually saw this where the heel manager would come out in a tuxedo and he would get disrobed. So we saw this a bunch of times on the main stage. Yeah. You know, again, I think it was something that I had seen a dozen times prior to this. So it didn't have a huge impact for me.
One of the things about this feud, at least the 1989 version, the matches themselves, of course, were just off the charts excellent. And I think I have maybe four of them in my top 100 because it was just like watching, as I mentioned in one other episode, it was like watching two old dance partners. But one of the things that I hated about this program was the whole family man versus the wild partying guy angle, because I thought that just killed Steamboat as a babyface. What about you?
Yeah, and it did, and I think it backfired. I think it was one of these things that kind of backfired, where he would come out with the little dragon, and his wife would come out in the sequin dress, and then Flair would come out, and Flair was ultra cool. So you had the family man, you know, white bread, family values, and then this guy who was just a party animal. I think it hurt Steamboat.
I think it did, because I think this was something, trying to sell that idea on a localized basis, like in Mid-Atlantic or something like that, I think it could have been more effective when you're dealing with a smaller fan base. But on a national scale, the guy that gets the women and, you know, is parading around, that's the guy that everyone's going to love. And I think you're exactly right. It completely backfired. And I, you know, I was just going, oh my God, why they want to do it? And they bring out his wife and his kid. And, you know, his wife has to have the sequin gown. She can't just dress like a wife. And it was, I remember, and this is slightly embarrassing. I remember seeing Bonnie with little Ricky walking around the arena. At some point during the card, myself and I believe Dave Meltzer were walking around in the arena. I don't know if we'd gone out to get something to drink or what, but here comes Bonnie, because it was before the main event, and she's got little Ricky in her arms. And so we go over and we say hi to her. I don't know if she knew Dave or what, but we're sitting there chit-chatting. So little Ricky has sort of like a little cowboy outfit on, right? So I made the unfortunate decision to comment how much I thought he looked like the Honky Tonk Man.
No, you didn't.
I got a look from Bonnie and Dave Meltzer, and I said, well, no, I'm probably wrong. I'm probably wrong about that. But yeah, that probably was not a good thing to say.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So who was making the decisions at this point that would think, okay, so the heel is going to be the guy that goes out and parties all night and gets all the really, really beautiful women? You know, who's coming up with that idea? Exactly.
Jim Herd was in charge. That's all I'll say. I don't know if it was his decision. Don't want to throw the blame on him. Maybe this was Ricky's decision that he wanted to go with the family man gimmick. I don't know. But in hindsight, probably not his greatest idea if it was Ricky. So the next one, Ted DiBiase is attacked by Dick Murdoch before his long-awaited match with Ric Flair. My writings here say, although DiBiase and Murdoch didn't draw money as feuds like Freebirds and Von Erichs or Hogan versus Savage or Hogan versus Orndorff, this was probably the best conceived, best orchestrated, and best performed skit of the decade. When DiBiase entered the ring for his match with Flair, Bill Watts regarded him as nothing more than pond scum. 5 minutes later, DiBiase was personally responsible for the U.S. victory in World War II. Barry, tell me what you remember about this terrific angle.
So what's funny about this is I haven't seen this in 30 years, and I clearly remember it, which just tells you how good it was. Murdoch beat the shit out of DiBiase, if I recall correctly. And Murdoch is a guy that, you know, in hindsight, I think of people, they kind of look back at it and they say, oh, yeah, Dick Murdoch, he was great. He could have been NWA champion. But Murdoch was like this old, reliable guy that you could call. He could come into any promotion, and he could make an impact. And he may not be your top guy, but he's going to be right there or right underneath. So I think it was great. Obviously, I put DiBiase over on every episode that for the 1980s, I think he and Barry Windham were probably the two best things going. So I think this is a fantastic angle.
Here's a couple things that I remember about this angle. Number one is Dick Murdoch, as you said, when he came to the arena and decided he was going to work, He may have been one of the top five guys in the world, because I've seen matches with him in Japan where he was teaming with Antonio Inoki, where he literally carried 95% of the match and was just tremendous. And a guy that you could see when they talk about this guy as a world champion, I see why. But on those other nights when Dick decided that he was going to play and have some fun, he could be a guy that, as they say, could show you a real stinker of a match. And you wonder, why is this guy even in the conversation as the top, you know, one of the top wrestlers in the world? But on this particular occasion, DiBiase gets the match. Murdoch comes in before Flair has come to the ring, I believe, and says, you know, Ted, you know, I trained you, and this is my time, and I think you need to step aside and let old Captain Redneck, let him take the match versus the world champion. This is my time. I deserve my match. And this escalates to where DiBiase gets sucker punched by Murdoch. They go out. He gives him the brainbuster on the floor. DiBiase, if he didn't hit an artery, he was darn close, because he was bleeding buckets. I mean, like one of the all time blade jobs, because it was just really, it was dare I say, worse than Don Kernodle in that famous tag match with Slaughter and Youngblood and Steamboat. But one of the things that I thought was so well done and so effective and made the angle so good is before they came back for the actual match, Bill Watts is on and speaking to the fans, and he says, "Now, fans, I want to warn all you parents who have children watching this program that DiBiase has gone and, you know, he's having a he didn't say hemorrhaging, but he's hit an artery, and he's giving like these medical terms about what's happened and how this may be something that you don't want your children to watch," which, of course, if you're a kid, you're going, "Oh, well, if they're not going to let me watch, I'm going in the other room to watch this, because, you know, that's the first sign that you're going to want to watch." So DiBiase comes back. He's got, I remember Watts saying that he's applied a pressure bandage to stem the blood flow. So DiBiase comes out. He's got this bandage that, of course, comes off within like 3 seconds. He and Flair start fighting. Now, honestly, the match with him and Flair, it was not what you would expect a match between Ric Flair and Ted DiBiase in 85 to be. I would have loved to have seen a 60-minute Broadway on television between those two. But they have a short brawl. Murdoch comes out again and disrupts the match. So it's not necessarily the match between DiBiase and Flair. It's the angle that involves Murdoch and DiBiase primarily. But you also have Flair as part of it. Steve Dr. Death Williams comes in towards the end. And this completely cemented DiBiase's babyface turn. And in future episodes, we're going to talk about one of the matches that I saw between these two that took place on New Year's Eve 1985 going into 1986 in Oklahoma City, that is one of the great throwdown brawls, just beating the snot out of one another, that you'll ever see. So, yeah, boy, this angle is tremendous. And if you haven't seen it yet and you call yourself a wrestling fan, you deserve to take yourself right to YouTube immediately and just click in Ted DiBiase and Dick Murdoch Mid-South angle and just sit there and afterwards say, "Gee, thank you, Jeff and Barry. I appreciate that." So the next one we're going to discuss is Akira Maeda gives Riki Choshu the infamous shoot kick, the effects of which are still being felt in wrestling. Now, Barry, before you comment, I will say that as we're recording this, I have just a couple days ago recorded an episode or a bit for the 605 Super Podcast, The Mothership, with my friend, the great Brian Last, and Dave Meltzer and Kurt Brown. We discussed this particular angle. So before we go too much into it and delve too much into it and the ramifications and everything that happened after this famous incident in Japanese wrestling history, I will say this will be discussed in much greater detail on your 605 Super Podcast. Barry, tell me what you remember about this angle.
Yeah, so it was a real big deal. I think from a historical perspective, and I can tell you that I actually saw this for the first time when your boy John McAdams sent me a copy of it. I think we traded a tape some 30 years ago. And, you know, it's a kick to the face, and that's pretty much what it is. But at the same time, the ramifications for this with him getting fired, you know, and everything that wound up taking place, it really did change the landscape of wrestling in Japan. So from that perspective, it really is a big deal. Again, you know, it is a kick to the face. Choshu's got somebody, I believe, in a Boston Crab or some version of a Boston Crab. Maeda comes, delivers an unprotected kick to the face. Really unprofessional, obviously calculated on his part. But I think, again, from a historical perspective, this is right up there.
A couple of things. First of all, it was a Scorpion Deathlock that he had. He had it on Osamu Kido. And what happened was, when the move was thrown, when the kick was thrown by Maeda, if you look closely at the tape, Choshu doesn't realize that it's a shoot. Because, you know, you see, you know, your Stan Hansens, your Tenrus, your Sarutas giving people kicks to the face and, you know, transition moves or big moves in matches. But what happens is after he kicks him, Choshu lets go of the hold and reaches up to his face, and he can feel his face immediately, because I believe he broke his orbital bone.
Right.
He can feel that the damage is done. And all of a sudden he turns and looks at Maeda and immediately goes after him. Maeda gets out of the ring. I believe Nobuhiko Takada, so it was a six-man tag match, gets him out of the ring. Kido goes over, who's on Maeda's team, and grabs Choshu and tries to get Choshu to continue working to go to the finish of the match, because he's realized what happened. And Choshu, after initially wanting to go after Maeda, turns back and he puts the finishing move on Kido so the match can finish up, which big thumbs up to Kido there for having the sense of professionalism to at least, finish off the match the way it was supposed to have been done. But once again, this was, for those of you who have never seen it, this was a really big deal in Japanese wrestling at the time. And historically speaking, is a really big deal in Japanese wrestling history. It's another thing I urge you to go out on YouTube. I'm pretty much willing to bet that on the New Japan World site, they do not have this incident because it was not something that promotion was really in favor of. So the next one we're going to talk about, Paul Orndorff turns on Hulk Hogan. Okay. So what I've written here was that Vince McMahon's best skit of the decade, even though the twin referee thing was funnier and more creative, best part was after the clothesline, as Vince is agonizing over the fallen Hulkster, Jesse Ventura on color commentary starts snickering, and Vince in mock outrage shouts, "You knew it all along, Jesse!" Barry, tell me what you remember about this great angle.
Yeah, so the truth is I don't remember a whole lot. I remember that Orndorff actually turned on Hogan, but I don't remember any of the specifics. I was I would watch the WWF at that point, but I don't think that I was, religiously following everything. I clearly do remember Orndorff, turning, but that's it. I really can't add a whole lot of context to it.
Well, thanks for nothing, Barry. And this show is nothing if not total preparation, I think you'll find out. And the good news is the next two things we're going to discuss are WWF stuff. So let's see if I'm going to be taking this by myself. How about, do you remember the Mean Gene workout video?
I do remember that.
Yes, the Mean Gene workout video, Gene Okerlund and Hulk Hogan trained together for their big match, I believe it was in Minneapolis, against Mr. Fuji and George Steele, which pretty much has to be a candidate for anyone's worst tag teams of the 80s list. But tell me what you remember about the Mean Gene workout video.
So I think if WWF at that stage was doing anything that was interesting in my perspective, it was things like the Mean Gene workout video. They did this great segment. We were just talking about Dick Murdoch, where Murdoch and Adrian Adonis were riding around on a motorcycle in Harlem. Do you remember that skit?
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it was like his Uncle Frankie or somebody they were actually looking for Adonis's Uncle Frankie. I forget what his name was. And of course, Fuji Vice, with Fuji and Morocco. I think all those Fuji skits with Morocco were just hysterical. But this was funny stuff. And, WWE had a way of kind of humanizing their stars, where I think that was something that, the NWA at that point really wasn't doing, where they would do these skits. And as comical as they were, if your audience is 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, this is going to resonate with them. So this was kind of funny stuff.
Well, and of course, what happened was you would have Hogan trying to train Okerlund for the big match. So he would have him out in the park jogging, and they would pass by like a hot dog stand, and Okerlund would stop and go, "Can you give me a beer and a brat there, buddy?" And Hogan would just be outraged that Gene was stopping training to stop and have a beer and a brat. I don't know. I don't remember what the match was, whether it was any good. I'm sure it probably wasn't. But it was pretty formulaic for what they were doing at the time. I'm sure the match lasted, if 5 minutes, that would be amazing. But somebody got the big Hogan leg drop. Mean Gene got his hand raised. He was really a well-known media figure in the Minneapolis-St. Paul market. So, it was a huge deal in Minneapolis. The next match, moment I'm going to discuss, that also is from the WWF, approximately that same time, Roddy Piper hits Jimmy Snuka across the face with a coconut to start up their feud. Tell me what you remember about that, Barry.
Yeah, so the difference with that was something that, if I'm correct, was actually, it was bigger than professional wrestling. It was something that was out there that I think Entertainment Tonight even showed the clip of that. So that was a big deal, and that was something that they played off of years later, and it's iconic. It's one of those moments. It's kind of like, where were you when Terry Funk gave Ric Flair a pile driver after the match with Steamboat? This is almost the same thing to me, in the sense that, this kind of made the whole Piper thing. Piper came in, nailed Snuka with the coconut. If I'm correct, Snuka was gone just a couple of months after this. I don't think he stuck around too much longer, which is a mistake, but just an iconic moment, and I think it really made Piper in the WWF.
One of the things that's pretty amazing is I was a huge, huge Roddy Piper mark in the early 80s when he was in Mid-Atlantic in Georgia. His partnership with Gordon Solie was one of my all-time favorite wrestling things because I thought they played off of each other so well. We discussed that in a prior episode when I was talking to Pam Allen, the daughter of Gordon Solie, who told me how much fun her dad had working with Roddy Piper in that scenario. All that being said, I hated Piper in the WWF. Not like I hated him because he's a heel. I hated what they turned his character in, because I was used to this smart ass, borderline sociopathic Roddy Piper from Georgia in the Mid-Atlantic, instead of this cartoon that he became. Although he was a great heel and made lots of money in the WWF, I really hated the WWF characterization of Roddy Piper as opposed to what he had been in Mid-Atlantic. Portland, too. He had did some great stuff in Portland and in Georgia.
Piper was one of those guys, too, and I had the pleasure of meeting Piper a couple of times at different fan fests, and he was arguably the most engaging guy, and you could go up to him, and I remember probably 5 or 6 years ago, I was with my son, and I went up to him, and somebody asked him about the whole thing. I asked him a question about working in Los Angeles with Chavo Guerrero, but somebody asked him about hitting Snuka with the coconut, and apparently the coconut wasn't a gimmicked coconut. Is what he said, and I forget exactly how he phrased it, but basically said that he really nailed Snook in the head and almost cracked his skull open.
Wow. I did not know. That's one thing I did not know about that. But I was a much bigger fan of Piper's run in Georgia and Mid-Atlantic. So the next one we're going to talk about, now this is an angle that may not have been seen by as many people, but I remember when I first saw this, thinking that not only was this a great angle to set up the program, but it was what I referred to as the chair shot of the decade. That is during the contract signing between the Midnight Express and the Fantastics in the Mid-South television show. And what I wrote was that Cornette and the Fantastics are signing the contract. Rogers and Fulton turn around and Bobby Eaton gives them both the greatest chair shots of the decade. Do you remember that, Barry?
I do remember that.
Just fantastic stuff. And the kind of chair shots, you look back at wrestling in the late 70s and early 80s, and chair shots were really not incredibly stiff in most cases, unless it was really called for. But this one, those guys both got laid out, and they were hard chair shots.
Yeah, and it's, I guess in a lot of ways, thank God we don't see chair shots like that anymore, because they were super hot. And that also reminds me of the whole angle with Terry Gordy, where he was just laying them out, and he picked up a chair, and he nailed them, and they were great. And the Fantastics were kind of underrated. They'll always be Rock and Roll Express light, I think, to a lot of people. But the quality of their matches, they were very solid. I never truly got into the whole bow tie and ass wiggling thing. I think for a lot of guys, that was probably something that we didn't want to see. But when the matches started, it was true. Look, we can say it. Bobby Fulton's a great guy. But at the same token, we really didn't want to watch guys wiggle their asses during the match. But that being said, as professional wrestlers, Tommy Rogers was terribly underrated. As a single, I think he was a guy who could have gone much farther, would have been 10 years earlier, like one of the junior heavyweight champions, like a Hiro Matsuda, Danny Hodge kind of deal, because he was so solid. But as a team, they were great. And of course, you're talking Bobby Eaton, you're talking the Midnight Express. There were years in the 80s as I was lamenting CWF and as I was watching my favorite promotion just die, that the reason I continued to watch professional wrestling was to be able to see the Midnight Express and Jim Cornette.
Yeah, no, this is really top-notch stuff. I, to be honest with you, haven't seen this recently. I don't know if it's out there on YouTube or not, but if you get a chance and somebody finds it, it's unbelievably well done. And, most contracts, I talked about the contract signing with Steamboat and Youngblood versus Slaughter and Carnotal. There are ones I remember right off the top of my head. I'm thinking of the one between Nikita Koloff and Magnum TA. You can tell the ones that are really well done and come off as, I don't want to say like a legitimate contract signing, but a really well done wrestling angle, and the ones that fall flat. This one, with the help of Bobby Eaton, which there's a great hand to go to, was really well done, and it's a great angle. So speaking of well done, the next three we're going to discuss are all Memphis angles that were some of the great moments of the decade for Memphis, which, I don't need to tell anyone that is a fan of Memphis wrestling that there's more than just one or two, but these are three that I picked out specifically. The first one, Eddie Gilbert presents This Is Your Life, Jerry Lawler. What I wrote was, this skit was so well done that it's unbelievable that it appeared on a wrestling show. Eddie reads through Jerry's career with Lance Russell looking on, and voices speak just like an old Ralph Edwards show. Barry, do you remember this angle?
Yeah, because I was lucky enough that I was actually getting the Memphis tapes at this point. So they could do no wrong. And even whatever they were doing wrong was still really enjoyable. So I remember this, and you're 100% right when you say how well done this was, that this is something that seems like it was produced for the big stage and not like a territory type of promotion. So, yeah, extremely well done. Huge Eddie Gilbert fan, as many of us were.
Yeah, and the thing that I loved about this so much is, you know, as I discussed in a prior episode, I believe Jerry Jarrett had a sign on his office. I believe it said issues create money or something along those lines, where personal issues between two people can be turned into a viable money-making thing. And I don't know whether or not Eddie Gilbert had legit heat with Jerry Lawler or not, but you really thought they did, even if you were a smart fan. I know a lot of people don't like that term, but if you were wise to what was going on, this really came off like a guy that really didn't like Jerry Lawler. And there were people that didn't like Jerry. And so that was what made it even more believable, because he was saying things about Jerry, like personal things about like his marriage and his life at home with his kids, that were just cutting to the bone. And you were like listening and you're going, oh man, that is pretty mean spirited. And Jerry just sat there and, to his credit, and took it. And it ended up resulting in a great short-lived angle between the two. But, yeah, this is super intense and super, super good stuff.
Yeah, I 100% agree, too. And Memphis was always doing something that was kind of unique like that. In those comments, and I know that there was some heat between Lawler and Gilbert, and you know, I know at times it was rectified, and other times there was massive heat. And knowing Eddie a little bit as I did when we were kids through the WFIA, he idolized Jerry Lawler. I know that, again, issues were coming up throughout the years, but this is really, really well done. And this is one of these things that I would encourage anyone listening, if they've never seen, to somehow, is this on YouTube? Do you know?
You know, I really don't know, but if it is, it's called This Is Your Life, Jerry Lawler. And it's, you know, Eddie Gilbert did it, and it is super. And I highly recommend it.
I'd agree.
So the next one we're going to talk about, again from Memphis, if Bobby Eaton threw the most famous chair shot of the decade, Randy Savage, I think, well, I won't say it was the most famous, because I'm going to discuss that at another time, the most famous pile driver of the decade. But one of the most famous pile drivers of the decade was Randy Savage in Memphis pile driving Ricky Morton through a table. Tell me what you remember about that that incident.
Yeah, so there was probably two or three things coming out of Memphis over the years that you were like, holy shit, did I just see that? And I would say one was when Joe LeDuc picked up Lawler, threw him over the top rope onto the table, and the
yes.
table didn't break. And you just go, oh my God, that's so painful. And obviously, Eddie Gilbert running Jerry Lawler over years later. But this is right there. And that took place in the Mid-South Coliseum, if I recall correctly.
Correct.
And what I liked about that, whenever they would show an angle or a match that had taken place in the Mid-South Coliseum, there was always something to it. It's a little darker, maybe a little more grainier, but it kind of picked up the atmosphere. And I remember Savage giving him that pile driver and just going, oh my God, he's dead. Morton is dead. That clearly stands out to this day.
Oh yeah. And you know, it just, it was just an amazing moment, and what an amazing performer Randy was at that time. And as good as he was when he got to the WWF, people that have never seen the stuff he did in Memphis or in ICW, he was just crazy. And,
yeah.
You know, so few people have actually had a chance to look at that stuff, but he was doing stuff that it's amazing that a major promotion didn't grab him sooner. And of course, it, you know, was probably due to the fact that he had a reputation as being, dare I say, just a little bit out there. And but what a tremendous performer, and you can't state that enough. Okay, the last one we're going to talk about today, and then at another episode, we're going to go through our top 10 wrestling memories of. But at number 11, Rick Rude smashes Jerry Lawler's car windshield with a sledgehammer. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, and that was great, too. So we were lucky. So living in South Florida at the time, we were actually getting the Memphis tapes, Memphis shows, on WSVN, on the Channel 7 television station. So I want to say it aired Saturday or Sunday. I think it was Sunday. It was airing at like 12 noon or 1 o'clock. And I would record all these shows. I think I was working at that time. So I would record all these shows, and I would come home and I would watch it. And Rude, I think, had just left Florida. Or was just, I'm sorry, Root was coming to Florida and was starting to wind up down there. But that was fantastic. And that was one that, you know, I actually remember calling my dad in my room to watch the videotape of this. I'm, Dad, you got to see this. That was great stuff.
Yeah, no, the stuff in Memphis was so edgy. And I think it was a situation where, you know, they were sort of, let's be honest, and I don't mean this in a bad way, they were kind of a mom and pop operation. And so to separate themselves from what was becoming bigger and bigger wrestling companies, they had to do stuff that, you know, set themselves apart. And holy cow, this kind of stuff definitely did. And as you mentioned, the incident where Eddie Gilbert ran over Jerry Lawler, you know, in the parking lot, it was just that that made Memphis just such a can't miss promotion, because, you know, you'd have one or two weeks where it's like, really nothing happened. And then that third week you tune in and boom, all of a sudden something would just happen that would set the territory on fire. And, you know, whether it was they were changing bookers at the time or just some sort of angle or some sort of feud caught fire with the fans. But yeah, no, that was great stuff. And, you know, one of the things that made Memphis such a must-see territory during the 1980s. Okay, so now we're going to finish up with our wrestling talk for the day, and we are going to switch gears. Barry and I are going to try to do something that, if you're a fan of this show, is virtually impossible, and that is to come up with our top five episodes of Seinfeld. This is not easy, I'm telling you, because if you're a fan of this show, you know, you have my sympathy in trying to come up with a top five episodes, because there were so many great and iconic episodes. One of the things Barry and I discuss that's actually sort of interesting is a lot of those shows that people regard as being the iconic episodes, you know, the Soup Nazi, for example, are not included on either one of our lists. And again, as I said, this is a completely subjective list, because everybody's got their own reasons for liking one episode over another. So I'm sure there's somebody right now out there listening going, what do you mean you don't have the Soup Nazi on there? That was the greatest episode ever. So that being said, Barry, let's talk top five Seinfeld episodes of all time. Hit me with one of your, and we're not going to do this as favorite, because I, you know, we each have our own favorite one episode. So just give me one from your top five.
Yeah, and we have to say also, subjective is absolutely this entire process is like that. These are strictly our opinions, and I went back, and as I was compiling, and I started off, and I think I had 25 episodes, and I narrowed it down to just five. But it, for me, it's the early seasons. It's like season 1, 2, and 3. So one episode that I really like came from season 3, and it was the Red Dot. And it was where Georgie got a cashmere sweater, gave it to Elaine as a present. Elaine immediately picks up on it, and he winds up giving it to the cleaning woman. So do you remember this episode?
Well, not only do I remember it, I can now cancel that from my top five, because now we're discussing this episode.
There you go.
The line I'll never forget from this episode is, oh, cashmere. And she starts telling this story, that the cleaning woman starts telling this story about when she lived in a small village as a little girl, and this man brought this cashmere sweater to her village and said, what is you call this? We call it cashmere. And then, of course, the subplot with a guy who is played by David Naughton from Dr. Pepper commercials and from the TV show Making It and from American Werewolf in London, plays the alcoholic. Who does he fall off the wagon or get back on the wagon? They weren't sure about that, but that involves somebody accidentally switching his drinks. Oh my God, this episode is a classic.
So this episode actually is a couple of things for me. This is the first episode where Art Vandelay makes an appearance. And this is during the interview. So George has got an interview with Mr. Littman, who was Elaine's boss at Pendant Publishing. And he goes, so who do you like? Well, I'm Lupica, Mike Lupica is a sports writer. I like Art Vandelay. And then he goes, who's Art Vandelay?
He's a very obscure writer. Yes.
Yeah, he's a beatnik from the village. What's he written? Phoenician Blinds. So I enjoy that too, but to me, the highlight of this episode is that George winds up sleeping with the cleaning woman, gets called into Mr. Lippman's office, and he goes, so did you sleep with the cleaning woman? Was that wrong? Should I not have done that? You know, like he's completely surprised. Clear out your desk. You're out of here. And he fires him. Yeah, so I love this episode. It's start to finish. Having David Naughton as the subplot, I think, was great with the drinking. But to me, this is George and the cleaning woman.
And not to correct you here, but I believe the line from Mr. Lippman once it's been brought to my attention that you had sex with the cleaning woman in the office. And well, is that wrong? Because I wasn't clear on that. And so, yeah, that's a that's a tremendous episode. So one of my top five, and I will tell you that having spoken to Barry about this before, this episode, this is strictly from my point of view, because this is not one that's tremendously high rated. It gets a very good rating. I go to the IMDb website for any of my movie and television reviews. And this is one that I'd probably be in their top 40, but I love it. And I love it because of someone who's not a regular on the show, who had a one-time appearance on the show. And it was so great and such an iconic performance by Philip Baker Hall in the episode called The Library. Barry, do you remember this episode?
Boy, do I remember this episode. I must have watched this when it took place, because I would record all these on videotape when we had videotape recorders at that time. And I went back, and his performance through the roof.
And he was, of course, the librarian who, ironically enough, was named Mr. Bookman.
Well, he wasn't. So he was, the librarian was a young lady dating Kramer.
Yes.
Right, exactly.
He was the library detective.
He was the library detective. Mr. Bookman, go figure.
Yes. And he has a couple of speeches that just to this day, and I mean, this show was probably on 25, 26 years ago, this episode ran. And when it's on repeats, he gives this speech where apparently Jerry had checked out a book. Was it Tropic of Cancer or Tropic of Capricorn? Do you remember?
Tropic of Cancer.
Okay, Tropic of Cancer. And he goes and he says, you know, I can't believe you're making such a big deal out of this. This happened in 1971. And Bookman says, yeah, 71. That was my first year on the job. Bad year for libraries. Bad year for America. Hippies burning library cards. Abby Hoffman telling everyone to steal books. I don't judge a man by the length of his hair or the kind of music he listens to. Rock was never my bag. But you put on a pair of shoes when you walk into the New York Public Library, fella. I mean, he was so great in his performance that he is in my top five episodes. Just because of the side bit with Kramer falling in love with the bookish librarian and her hiding the romance from Mr. Bookman, the library detective, just classic stuff. Okay, Barry, what's your next one?
Well, but you're leaving out this part also. So there's a flashback scene where they go into the gym locker room and George has got this afro, like an afro I used to have 35 years ago. And they're in there and they give George, I guess, the atomic wedgie.
Yes.
And the book falls underneath. So the gym teacher actually takes it. And then the last scene of the episode is he's like homeless. He's lying on the street with the book next to him and is going, can't stand you.
Exactly. And you know, that's where he was so memorably described by George as having baked bean teeth.
Those little baked bean teeth. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. No, just a tremendous, tremendous episode. Okay. What's your next one?
My next one, The Bubble Boy, season 4. So it's this is actually twofold. The Bubble Boy also comes into Kramer burning down Susan's father's cabin, Cherish the Cabin. And I just love it. But to me, the episode is really, the whole juxtaposition of the episode is George's conversation with the Bubble Boy. And when they walk in the room.
The yeah,
exactly.
Moves.
But when they walk in and they meet the Bubble Boy for the first time, you know, the Bubble Boy looks at them and goes, he looks at Susan and goes, what's your story? And Susan is like, I don't have a story. And George says, well, she works for NBC. And then he goes, why don't you take your top off? So the mother looks at him and goes, Donald, behave yourself. And Bubble Boy is like, come on. So I think it's great. They're playing the game, and you're 100% right. We're always going to remember this episode as the Moops. And to me, it's funny. It's like Bubble Boy is completely this asshole antagonistic kid, and he's totally baiting George. How you doing over there, George? Not too good, I bet. And George is like, all right, Bubble Boy, let's just play. So who invaded Spain in the 8th century? That's a joke. The Moors. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's the Moops. The correct answer is the Moops. And then they get into this big fight, and obviously the bubble bursts. But I can watch this episode, and I can watch this at any time, and I'm still going to laugh.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic, and it's great because the kid is such a heel playing on people that, let's face it, are usually sort of subtle heels within the show, because part of the appeal of Seinfeld was that you were talking about four people who are kind of unlikable and very narcissistic, but here they manage to meet someone who's a bigger narcissist than they are.
Yeah, so I actually have a trivia question. Do you remember Bubble Boy's father and who he was and what his occupation was in the episode?
He was played by Brian Doyle Murray, of course.
There's one.
And he was a driver for, I know he's like a truck driver, but I can't remember for what company. Go ahead.
You're right. Come on, you're right there. He's a truck driver for Yoo-Hoo.
Yoo-Hoo, that's right. Yoo-Hoo, I love Yoo-Hoo.
Jerry looks at him and goes, Yoo-Hoo, that's a fine product. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a great episode. And then the town chases him out of town because they shut off the oxygen for the Bubble Boy. That's such
Somebody
a dark
the Bubble Boy.
It's such a dark episode.
Yeah, super dark.
Yeah. So my next one that I'm going to talk about is an episode titled The Switch. And what this is about was Jerry is dating a girl that I believe she doesn't laugh at any of his jokes, but her roommate finds Jerry hysterical. So the key point in the episode is when Jerry is sitting down to talk to George, and he's trying to let George know what his intentions are, that he wants to dump the girlfriend and hook up with her roommate. He wants to pull the switch. And George, and it just an incredible, incredible piece of dialogue, says, if what you're talking about, and I think I do, is what you're suggesting, I suggest you get up, walk away, and never mention this again. Barry, tell me you remember this.
I remember that episode, too, and it was great. So this also raises the question, and people will say, okay, who was your favorite character? And I think my least favorite character was always Jerry. And the truth was, Jerry was the straight man for the most part. Even though he was the comedian, he was the straight man for everybody else. But a lot of times that dialogue, and this is a great point, that dialogue between Jerry and George, to me, was the highlight of the show. And it's almost this Big Lebowski-ist thing for me, where, to me, the Big Lebowski, remove the story, has nothing to do with it. To me, the Big Lebowski is really the conversations between Lebowski and Walter. And it's the same way for Seinfeld. As long as Jerry and George are talking to each other, I'm going to be happy.
Well, and, you know, of course, the whole show was based on conversations that Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David would have in a diner or a coffee shop after they had performed in New York, you know, in the early part of the 80s, I think. And that's where the genesis of the show about nothing came from. So my favorite part of the episode, as I'm talking about, is where they sit down and try to come up with an idea so that Jerry can end up with the roommate instead of the girl that he's dating, hence the title, The Switch. But my favorite line from the show itself was when they finally come up with what they believe is a plausible idea that will make this happen. And George says to Jerry, do you ever get down on your knees and thank God that you know me and have access to my dementia?
Yeah. And that was really hysterical too. And I love it. Great episode. Also didn't make my top five, would probably make my top 10 though.
So, okay. What's your next one? That'd be your number three.
So this one I'm actually going to get out of my comfort zone, and I'm going to space out of seasons 1 through 3. I'm going into season 5, and it's the marine biologist. And part of the great thing with George too was George was always telling these lies. It was to impress somebody, whether it was, you know, and usually it was a girl, but you know, he pretended to be a marine biologist, and he was trying to get this girl, and it was somebody that I guess he had grown up with or somebody that he knew. But in George's case, and this always seemed to be the way, George pretends to be a marine biologist and then winds up taking a walk on the beach, and there's a whale struggling to get back in the water. And, you know, of course, George has no shot. People are saying, running up and down the beach going, is there a marine biologist here? And the girl goes, oh, my God, George, that's you. So George has to come clean with her. She basically dumps him. But there's a great line in this episode, and I use this whenever I just want to say something stupid, which is literally most of the time. The sea was angry that day, my friends. And I'll say this line at any point. I'll be with my kids, and I just out of nowhere I'll be, the sea was angry that day, my friends. This is also an episode because this is where Jerry talks about Golden Boy. Are you familiar with Golden Boy?
Golden Boy is shirt, of course.
Exactly. So do you remember what happens to Golden Boy?
I know that he has to replace Golden Boy with Blue Boy eventually.
There you go. That was it. Golden Boy has an accident. He's got to be replaced with Blue Boy. So I love this episode. Probably it's in my top five, obviously. I'll say it's number three.
Okay. My next one, I will only say before I go to my next one that I perhaps will be mentioning that particular episode before we're through here today. So my next episode is an episode that's titled The Junior Mint.
Oh.
And The Junior Mint was this was one of those episodes where there was literally so much going on with what they were doing. It involves a old boyfriend of Elaine's who has come back into the picture and has lost apparently a pretty substantial amount of weight. And Elaine has become interested in him. He's a painter. He's got some artwork that George, thinking that the guy is going to die, decides to invest in, and he ends up having to go in and have surgery. Jerry and Kramer decide that they want to go in and watch the procedure. As Jerry says famously, let's go in and watch him cut that bastard up, and just tell me what you remember about the Junior Mint.
Well, I can tell you that the day after this episode aired, I actually went out and bought a pack of Junior Mints, not having eaten that delicious candy in probably 20 years prior. So that was great. So I thought it was really funny, and I liked it. I like the whole setup of where they're actually watching the surgery. I guess it was a teaching hospital, and they're watching the surgery, and Kramer's on like the lanai area, the second floor, and he's eating the Junior Mint, and it drops, and it goes directly into the guy's open wound, whatever the open wound was. So,
and it stems really off the infection.
He saved his life. It staved off the infection.
Yeah, there was just so much going on there. And then there was the bit where she, at first, Elaine wanted Jerry to be her boyfriend so that the guy wouldn't ask her out again. Then she sees that he's lost a ton of weight. So she's like, oh, hi, how you doing? And Jerry's like, Elaine, weren't we supposed to go to the Poconos? And she's like, no, that didn't, because she's, trying to weasel and, get back in the poor artist's good graces. And then, of course, the part where George is completely outraged because the guy lives. And so the artwork that he's bought now is worthless, and it's George is screwed again, which is like a recurring theme during this show. But no, just a great episode. Okay, what's number two?
So number two for me is The Limo. Go back to season three, and this was the episode with Murphy and O'Brien. And this is where Jerry and George get picked up, and they pretend to be Murphy and O'Brien without really understanding who Murphy and O'Brien are, that apparently they're neo-Nazis. And they want to get a limo, so they wind up getting picked up, and they become Nazis. And it was just really funny because a lot of times Seinfeld has always been called the show that's about nothing. And this was a great episode because really it wasn't about a whole lot other than just a lot of them just having a good time in this episode. So I think what I like about this episode, it's kind of twofold. I do love the whole Murphy and O'Brien thing, and Jerry and George have this conversation where they go, I'm Murphy. No, I'm Murphy. I'm O'Brien. They kind of fight. They're going to fighting over who's going to be Murphy and O'Brien, but George then takes a little bit of a fancy to the female Nazi. And there's this conversation, and George, if you look at George in any way, George is, she's into me. So he looks at Jerry, and he's like, do you see the way she's looking at me? And Jerry looks at him and goes, she's a Nazi, George, she's a Nazi. And he goes, I know, but she's kind of a cute Nazi, though. So I thought that was just really funny. But there's also this whole thing where Jerry totally messes with Elaine, and she's going to pick up this writer, and they're talking about War and Peace. And Jerry tells Elaine the story that originally War and Peace was war, what is it good for? And I guess she doesn't realize that Jerry's kidding, and she relays this to the author, who then gets offended. So have you ever seen this episode?
Oh, my God. War, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing.
And then Elaine is, they're talking, so Kramer's talking about, because now Jerry and George are on TV, and they're showing them as neo-Nazis, O'Brien and Murphy, and Kramer's talking to Elaine, and he goes, there's always been something really strange about Jerry. He's always so clean and organized, and Elaine is, I know Jerry. He's a Nazi. He's not a Nazi. He's just neat. So this is one of those episodes, again, that I can watch, and the more that I watch it, I'll still laugh, you know, 25, 30 years later.
I was just taking a sip of water here, and I almost did a spit take when you reminded me of that scene where, you know, Jerry, there's always something about him that's bothered me. I remember what cracked me about this is when they're in the car and the Nazis get in the back of the limo with them, and they're trying to decide who's Murphy and who's O'Brien. And he says, are you Murphy? And Jerry goes into this really fake Irish accent and says, oh, I'm Murphy. Yes, lad. Oh, the Pete. I remember the Pete. And then Kramer gets in the car, and Kramer's doing, hey, Murphy, hey, O'Brien, what's going on?
Right,
and the
right.
Nazis just going, wait a minute, he's Murphy, he's O'Brien. Yeah, that was, oh, wow, yep. That was such a fun episode. Okay, my next one, which would be my number two, is an episode that is titled The Boyfriend. The Boyfriend was actually a two-part episode. It's famous for having baseball star Keith Hernandez as a guy who dates Elaine for a period of time. But as fun as that is, and it deals with people that will help other people move, and that's when you're really committed to being a friend, when you'll help somebody move. But the best part of this episode is the reenactment of the JFK assassination. And as we talked before, talk about dark moments in the show. They're making fun of a presidential assassination. You know, I've always heard that comedy is tragedy plus time. And boy, that is the case here, because just about 30 years after the Kennedy assassination. And what they were really doing was making fun of the movie JFK and all the thing with, you know, back and to the left with the Zapruder film and all that kind of stuff. But when Jerry sits there and he reenacts it by putting Newman, who we haven't even got to talk about Newman yet, for God's sake. Newman is in the front and Kramer's in the back. And he says, when discussing their theory of what happened regarding an incident that occurred at a ball field where apparently Newman had spilled a beer onto one of the Mets players and had been spit on. And so he had decided he thought it was Keith Hernandez because they had been walking past Keith Hernandez. And so they were outraged. And ever since that day, they, in the immortal words of Newman, they loathe Keith Hernandez for allegedly spitting on him. So then they're reenacting what happened. And Jerry explains their theory of what happened by saying, unfortunately, the immutable laws of physics contradict the whole premise of your account. Allow me to reconstruct this, if I may, for Miss Bennis, as I've heard this story before a number of times. Newman, Kramer, if you'll indulge me. According to your story, Keith passes you and starts walking up the ramp. Then you say you were struck on the right temple. The spit then proceeds to ricochet off the temple, striking Newman between the third and fourth rib. The spit then came off the rib, turned, and hit Newman in the right wrist, causing him to drop his baseball cap. The spit then splashed off the wrist, pauses in midair, mind you, makes a left turn, and lands on Newman's left thigh. That is one magic loogie.
I think you just did that 100% as it actually came from the show. So that was pretty incredible right there. This is such a good episode. And it was funny. I was living in New York City when this episode aired, and Keith Hernandez was living literally in the same neighborhood. So it was the Upper East Side in the 50s. And we would actually see him going up and down the street. And every time, in my head, I'm always just thinking, you know, I could be your boyfriend, you know, I could be your boyfriend. And it's just great because here Elaine is dating him, but the truth is Jerry really wants to be his best friend. And this is where I learned the boundaries of friendship with helping somebody move. I never truly ever thought about that or realized that previously. So I love this episode.
Yeah. And the whole thing where Jerry has a date and she breaks it to go out with Keith Hernandez. And then Elaine says, wait a minute, are you jealous of me or him? And that fits so perfectly in with what you just described about the whole potential bromance, I guess they'd say, that that Jerry wants to have with Keith. You know, one of the things we forgot to mention that was also great about this episode was here again is that that man that we mentioned previously, Art Vandelay, because George is at the unemployment office and tells the crew, the gang, that he's applied for a job at Vandelay Industries. And if anyone calls, tell them that he's being considered for a job at Vandelay Industries. And that's how you should answer. And that whole thing where he comes out of the bathroom with his pants down by his ankles because Vandelay Industry is calling. Yeah, that's just great stuff, too.
That is great stuff, too. And Art Vandelay made such an impression on me that when I was actually going out to restaurants and making reservations, I would use the name Art Vandelay.
As opposed to Abe Froman, the Sausage King of Chicago?
Another excellent name. Absolutely. Of course.
So, okay, what's your tell us your number one. Before you do, tell me, because I'm going to do this too, tell me some of the ones that didn't make your top five. Without going into too much detail, just give the name of the episode.
Yeah, so the ones that didn't make it, the Soup Nazi is probably a big one because that's one that kind of put everything, that's where kind of just puts, you know, Seinfeld in the stratosphere. So I don't have any episodes with Jack Klompas. And there was the episode The Pen, if you remember The Pen, and it writes upside down. It's a space pen. And it was also the Cadillac episode. I liked that one a lot. That's with Elaine. Stella! Elaine takes the pain medication because they've been sleeping on the pullout couch, if you remember that. So I think those are the ones. I did like The Close Talker, Judge Reinhold.
Yeah.
I liked that one a lot. Those are the ones I were probably like bubbling right underneath my top five. And the truth is, if you ask me again next week, they could be in the top five.
Okay, what's your number one?
My number one is the Chinese restaurant, and it will always be the Chinese restaurant. This, to me, is really exactly what Seinfeld is. It's a show about nothing, and here is an episode based around three best friends trying to go see a movie, arguably the greatest bad movie of all time, you know, Plan 9 from Outer Space, and they're waiting, and it's basically them waiting for a table. So I think this episode, and again, this is just dialogue. There's not a lot of action. There's nothing really happening. There's just this dialogue, and I love this episode from every different level. First off, I love the movie Plan 9 from Outer Space, and there's this great conversation between Jerry and Elaine where, you know, Jerry's intent, we've got to make this movie, and Elaine is, well, it's just a movie, and Jerry comes back, just a movie? Don't you understand? This isn't plans 1 through 8 from outer space. This is plan 9. This is the one that worked, the worst movie ever made. And, you know, realistically, it's not the worst movie ever made, though a lot of people think that it is. But at the same time, I love Plan 9 from Outer Space. I love all the Ed Wood movies. So the fact that it gets a shout out, I think that's great. The other thing that I love is the guy who plays the maitre d' at the Chinese restaurant. It's James Hong. And James Hong has been in every movie ever made. He's Big Trouble in Little China. He played Lo Pan. And there's this great scene where, you know, he's gone up and he's given his name, which is Costanza. And, you know, they're talking and George is on the phone and he's yelling and he's going, Cartwright! Cartwright! So George gets off the phone and he goes over and he's like, you know, we've been waiting how long? And he goes, oh, no, I already called your name. And he goes, oh, yeah, I called Cartwright. And he goes, well, my name's Costanza. And he goes, that's right. And I yell Cartwright. And George kind of just shakes his head a little bit, very confused, and walks away and goes to explain it. But there's also this one has got one of the most quotable lines of all times, and it's where George, who's upset about the phone because he can't get on the phone because he's trying to reach the girl that he's dating, and he goes, we're living in a society.
I was going to say, let me say the line. We're living in a society here.
And you do it much, much better than I do. So, yeah, exactly. But I thought that was great. And then there's also this scene where George has the guy's on the phone, and George is trying to get off the phone and get this guy off the phone. And the guy just keeps turning around, just kind of pushing him off. So George goes up to Jerry, and he's like, you know, if anything goes down here, can I count on you? And Jerry's like, what are you talking about? He goes, yeah, if we decide to go at it. And Jerry looks at him and goes, yeah, I want to get into a rumble. So I love the dialogue. I love the fact that they spend 23 minutes just waiting for a table and all these things are happening. And yeah, it's my number one.
Well, that is a great episode. It's not in my top five, but it's a great episode. There's a couple things I love about this show episode. As you said, James Hong, Big Trouble in Little China was such a great movie for fans of movies of the 80s. If you haven't seen that, that's definitely where it's this karate fantasy. It's hard to describe that movie, but it's one of Kurt Russell's best movies, and he's terrific in it. A couple other things, though, that I remember is where they try to make Elaine. Jerry says, there's $25 in it for you, because Elaine wants to go over and start eating food off someone's table because they're so hungry. But yep. Yeah, that's great. And yeah, it's just so much, so much fun. So before I get to my number one episode, I wanted to tell you some of the ones that didn't quite make my list. but are great episodes. The Tape is an episode where Elaine leaves a dirty message on Jerry's answer machine as a joke, and George hears it and becomes infatuated with Elaine. And that is the episode that has the great scene where, once again, we talk about how this is the staple of the show itself. George and Jerry talking, and Jerry tells George about the girl's dirty talk, and how Jerry was not familiar with that, and the girl started talking dirty to him. So he tried to respond with some dirty talk of his own, and it didn't quite work out so well. So then The Ticket, which is about Newman getting a traffic ticket and going to great lengths to get the traffic ticket dismissed by taking the witness stand. The Hot Tub, which is about a marathon race. And then Jean-Paul, the marathon runner, who doesn't want to oversleep and wants to make sure that that alarm clock goes off. Great episode. The Jimmy, which is about
Jimmy. And in the third person, where he refers to himself.
Yeah. Well, and as great as that is in the episode, the best part of that episode is where Kramer goes to the dentist and gets Novocaine in his mouth, and so he's talking with a slur, and somehow gets people mistake him for someone who has a special need, and so Mel Torme, the Velvet Fog, is singing to Kramer at the end of the show. The Hamptons, which is of course famous for the line, "You gotta come see the baby." The puffy shirt, "I don't want to be a pirate." Let's see, the contest, of course. Are you in? Are you in? You know,
was
and
the Hamptons also shrinkage.
Yes, significant shrinkage.
Significant shrinkage, yeah.
Yes. Let's see. And then we had my number one show, which, as Barry mentioned before, is The Marine Biologist.
Wow.
Let me tell you how much I love this episode. I have people at the courthouse that I've known for 25, 30 years who are fans of Seinfeld also. And we will see each other at the end of the hallway. And my friend David Frankel, who's an attorney here in Fort Lauderdale, will yell down the hallway. He'll go, "Is anyone here a marine biologist?" And we'll start shouting out Seinfeld quotes to one another. And that's always the one that starts it, because it's such a great scene. Diane DeCahn, I believe, was the woman that George was so impressed that the woman had remembered it. And if you recall, the scene is that Jerry is trying to withdraw money from an ATM, and the woman that would be that he'd realized was Diane DeCahn is next to him, and Jerry is racing her to get his money out of the ATM first. And he's going, "Okay, punching in, good, receipt, okay, and yes, I win." And she's like looking at him, "Well, what kind of idiot are you trying to race me at an ATM?" And then she realizes that it's Jerry Seinfeld, who she went to high school with. And then she asks about George, and George is so captivated with this woman. So he, of course, can't tell her that he's unemployed. He tells her that he's a marine biologist. Or was it Jerry that told Diane that George is a marine biologist? Yes, Jerry tells her.
Yeah, it was
her,
Jerry that. Yeah,
because
and then George
says,
went along with it.
Yeah, George says, "Why didn't you tell her I was an architect? I've always wanted to pretend I was an architect." So he walks with her on the beach where there's a whale on the beach, and it was Larry David's voice that says the famous line, "Is anyone here a marine biologist?" And so George is retelling the story at the diner afterwards, and this is the dialogue. "The sea was angry that day, my friends, like an old man trying to send back soup at a deli. I got about 50 feet out, and suddenly the great beast appeared before me. I tell you, he was 10 stories high if he was afoot. As if sensing my presence, he let out a great bellow. I said, 'Easy, big fella.' And then, as I watched him struggling, I realized that something was obstructing its breathing. From where I was standing, I could see directly into the eye of the great fish, mammal, whatever. Well, what did you do next? Well, then from out of nowhere, a huge tidal wave lifted me, tossed me like a cork, and I found myself right on top of him, face to face with the blowhole. I could barely see from the waves crashing down upon me, but I knew something was there. So I reached my hand in, felt around, and pulled out the obstruction. Well, what is it? A tidalist? It's a hole in one." And that played into a scene that had happened earlier where Kramer was out golfing on the beach, and George had found the golf ball that Kramer had sent out, and it had gotten stuck into the whale's blowhole. And one of the things that's so great about Seinfeld, as we wrap up this week's episode, is one of the things the show had a tendency to do was that it wrapped up every episode by calling back something that had happened previously in the show.
Yeah, so you just said something, too, that made me think. And you said, you did it in great detail about the ATM scene. Do you remember Bosco?
Oh, yeah. That was password.
That was the password. And that's where, yeah, and that was her final word. Remember? Bosco. That was Jay Peterman's mother as she was sitting on her deathbed. And that was a character we didn't even mention. I thought Jay Peterman was one of the,
yeah,
great characters.
You think about it, the line that was just shown. There were, Jay Peterman says, there were rumors that Mama had taken a lover. And maybe that's a clue to her lover's identity. You know, you talk about, as we wrap up here, some people that we didn't mention that were great characters besides Jay Peterman. You had Jerry's parents. I told people once at my parents' 50th wedding anniversary, I said, I woke up one day and I realized that my parents had become Jerry Seinfeld's parents, because so much of what his parents did, I could relate to my own parents. And the interaction between Jerry's parents and George's parents, you know, Serenity Now, Insanity Forever. But
Lloyd Braun. Yeah.
Yeah, Lloyd Braun. You had, of course, one of the great episodes with Babu.
Babu
Bhatt. He's a very, very, very bad man. You know what's so amazing about this show? It's so amazing that this show was such a well-written, well-done show, and the series finale was such a the proverbial fart in church.
It was. It was horrific. So Larry David's got kind of this thing, and I do you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I don't watch it regularly. I've watched it here and there. It's a very funny show. And like Seinfeld, it's very dark.
It's very dark. It's kind of Seinfeld, but tweaked a little bit, and a lot of profanity and adult themes. But so Larry David's got this thing where, like, the first season episode for this year, which, you know, just aired maybe a month or two ago, I thought was terrible. And it reminded me of the finale. And what part of it was he was cramming the entire, everybody who had ever been a character, every storyline, everything was crammed into it. And that's kind of what the finale was. The finale brought everybody back, and there was just nothing funny about it. And I couldn't stand it. So the finale was terrible, but, you know, I think the only cool part I would say of the finale was being able to see all of the characters one last time. At the same time, the episode was bad. But there, you know, Jay Peterman, Babu Bhatt, remember Ping the Chinese delivery boy?
Yes. With the
was great.
His sister, who was a killer. She was a killer in the courtroom.
That's right. His sister was the killer in the courtroom. Newman, we definitely didn't give enough attention to. And I'll tell you another episode I really liked was the Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcaller.
Yeah, they thought Kramer was the pimp.
When he was the pimp, when the girls were sleeping in the back of the cars in the parking lot. Another great episode. I love this all day.
Yeah, no, and the one I just realized I'd forgotten was the one where George is converting to Latvian Orthodox.
Oh, remember that? Yeah.
Yeah, the Kvorka, the lure of the Kvorka.
The Kvorka.
Oh, your joy, and George's parents were so, are you brainwashed? Are you joining a cult? And then the great episode where George goes to visit his mom. It might have been the episode, the contest where the girl next to his mom is getting a sponge bath.
Yeah, that's right.
George, yeah. George, are you listening to me? I want something to drink. I'm very thirsty. Give it a minute, Mom. Give it a minute. Anyway, folks, we could honestly sit here and talk another couple hours just about Seinfeld. It was such a great show. On that note, I would like to say thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. I want to thank all those who do. I want to thank Brian Last and the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network for all their help and assistance. I want to thank my friend Scott Teal. Publishing out there at crowbarpress.com. My book, Breaking Kayfabe, is still available. You can follow me on Twitter at #BowdrinJeff. I want to, once again, a special shout out. I did it last week, but I want to mention again, Travis Heckle. Thank you for the fantastic artwork. Until next time, folks, have a good one.